Saturday, February 27th, is the International Day of the Polar Bear. For many, the polar bear and its loss of habitat have become the symbol of the effects of climate change on wildlife. I'm Rick Howlett. Today on In Conversation, we'll talk about the plight of the polar bear and climate change in general, globally and in our region. Joining us will be conservationist Jeff York of the group Polar Bears International, John Waltzak, director of the Louisville Zoo, which has two polar bears in its Glacier Run exhibit, and Dr. Dataki Osborne-Jelks, who's an environmental scientist based in Atlanta. We want to hear from you, too. Call us with your thoughts as we discuss climate change, polar bears, and more on In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. Welcome to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett in Louisville. Good to have you with us today. Today we're going to talk about climate change, its effect now and in the future on the environment, and what we're doing to push back against the effects of climate change and prevent future damage. And we're also going to focus a lot of the show on the plight of the polar bear as it relates to climate change and loss of habitat. Why polar bears? First of all, tomorrow is the International Day of the Polar Bear. Many people point to the polar bear as a prime example when it comes to illustrating the detrimental effects of climate change. And at least two polar bears live in Kentucky. Connick and Lee live at the Louisville Zoo. We'll talk about them shortly. Let's bring our guests aboard. First of all, welcome to Dr. Dataki Osborne-Jelks, Assistant Professor of Environmental and Health Sciences at Spelman College in Atlanta. Back in 2001, Dr. Jelks co-founded the Atlanta Earth Tomorrow Program, a National Wildlife Federation program that connects urban youth to nature, civic engagement, and leadership development. And among many other roles, she is the board chairperson for the West Atlanta Watershed Alliance, an organization that she helped found. Dr. Jelks, good to have you with us. Dr. Jelks, are you there? Oh, okay, we'll see if we can connect with Dr. Jelks. Jeff York is Polar Bear International Senior Director of Conservation. He has more than 20 years of Arctic field experience, most recently as the Arctic Species and Polar Bear Lead for the World Wildlife Federation's Global Arctic Program. Jeff has dedicated his career to the conservation of polar bears and their Arctic home. He's based at PBI headquarters in Bozeman, Montana. Jeff, good to have you with us. Jeff's not there either. Okay, we'll see if we got the director of the Louisville Zoo, John Waldzak. Are you with us, John?
Yes, thanks for having us. I'm sure hopefully we'll get everybody else on too.
Yeah, we got a clunky phone system here in this age of COVID, so we'll get it fixed up here. But let me introduce you, John. Of course, you're the executive director of the Louisville Zoo. You came to the Louisville Zoo in 1985 to design, build, and establish a collection for the zoo's Herp Aquarium. He's been instrumental in the growth of the Louisville Zoo and has served as the director since 2004. And this week, he announced his retirement from the zoo. John, welcome, and congratulations on your retirement.
Well, thank you, Rick. I appreciate that. It's been absolutely a labor of love, and I look forward to the future of the zoo and staying involved with conservation efforts.
We want to hear from our listeners, too, of course. Call us at 502-814-TALK, 502-814-8255. What are your thoughts about climate change and the effect it has on you and the environment and wildlife? We want to hear what you think. 502-814-TALK, 502-814-8255. You can send us a tweet. We're at WFPL News, and we're also on Facebook. Do we have our other guest lined up? Jeff, are you there?
Yes, I am. Oh, thanks for having me this morning.
Welcome to the program, Jeff. And Dr. Jelks, are you with us?
I'm here. Thank you.
Oh, good to have everyone on board. That's a relief. Okay. I want to set the scene here, Dr. Jelks, with kind of a big picture of view. From your perspective, where do we stand as a planet and here in the U.S. as a country in terms of battling the effects of climate change? Of course, many measures have been taken, some rolled back and reinstated here in our country. From your perspective, again, are we making progress? Where do we stand right now?
Wow, thank you so much for that question. It's a loaded question. I think that there is so much that needs to be done and that is so urgent about climate change. While some progress is being made, there's still a lot to do. Climate change is an existential threat that is impacting, our entire planet. Globally, it has wide-ranging impacts. We see the impacts in places like the United States as well. There's a lot that really needs to be done for us to kind of turn the tide and to, change the direction that we're moving in. I'm encouraged by things, President Biden making climate change a priority for his administration. I'm encouraged by things like the U.S. rejoining the Paris Climate Agreement. And I'm also encouraged by the actions that I see happening in a lot of local communities across this country, where local municipalities are taking stances. Colleges and universities are doing their part. And local community-based groups are also making change happen, both by trying to advance policy, but also by working on kind of everyday solutions that can help us try to, turn the tide and help us to recover from some of the impacts that we're already experiencing from climate change, but hopefully to also ward off some of the devastation that might be to come.
You mentioned the Paris Climate Agreement. Can you give us just a little overview about what that is? Because we heard a lot about it when former President Trump withdrew from it, and it's come up again, of course, with President Biden. One of his first actions after taking office was to rejoin the agreement. Can you give us just a nutshell of what it is and why it's important?
Well, the Paris Climate Agreement is it's important because, it's an international agreement. It's really important for the United States as well as other countries because, countries are coming together to say collectively, we see climate change as a problem, we see it as an existential threat, and we're going to make some commitments to try to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, which we know to drive climate change when we think about carbon dioxide in particular. And so when we think about, some of the main causes of climate change and how it is already and has the potential to wreak havoc, on our natural ecosystem, being a part of this agreement and making it a priority is about, committing to doing something about it, to taking common sense actions to reduce emissions. In the various countries that have agreed to be a part of it. And if we want to have some significant impact on climate change, then bold actions like this agreement are going to help us to get there. If you have countries that are agreeing to it and are taking action, especially some of the most affluent countries, which are contributing most to the problem.
I want to come back to you, Dr. Jelkson, talk specifically about what you're doing in your part of the country. A lot of exciting things going on around there, but I want to turn to Jeff York and talk about polar bears a little bit. Jeff, let's start just, if you give us, for those who are not familiar with your organization, tell us about Polar Bears International and what you do there.
Sure. So Polar Bears International is the world's only polar bear-focused conservation organization. And we work just to keep polar bears in the Arctic always. Initially, back when we were formed, we dealt with typical wildlife conservation issues, things like human-wildlife conflict, things like harvest, things like protecting denning areas, and climate change wasn't, high on the radar of things. And boy, how times have changed. Climate change and sea ice loss due to climate warming is now the leading threat to polar bear conservation long-term by several orders of magnitude over everything else that they face. So that has become a much larger piece of what we look at as an organization.
And you specifically, you actually go there. You go to the Arctic and you've been studying the polar bears. Tell us a little bit about that. What have you seen happen over your decades working there?
Sure. I've been incredibly fortunate to have spent 16 years out on the sea ice, mostly off Alaska and the southern Beaufort and Chukchi Seas, capturing, tagging, and working with polar bears in the wild. And subsequent years working with partners like John's staff there at the Louisville Zoo and others on bears in captivity. And what I've seen going back to my first days of working in Arctic Alaska back in the summer of 91 is then the sea ice never left shore more than, say, 4 to 5 miles. You could always see what we call pack ice or drift ice coming and going. Today, when I stand on that same shoreline, the sea ice can be 400 to 500 miles offshore. It's dramatic change just in my short career.
And so a lot of times we hear the term extinction being thrown around. How endangered is the polar bear right now because of this, and how dire is the threat of extinction?
Compared to some species, we're actually in a good place with polar bears in terms of their total global numbers. Our best estimates put them anywhere from 16 to 26,000 animals right now. That's a big range, and that range exists because we don't have good monitoring information for much of the Arctic. However, this threat they face, as Dr. Jelk said, is existential, and it is happening at 2 to 3 times the rate in the Arctic as it is down here where we live. And so polar bears and other Arctic species are quickly feeling the impacts of that habitat loss, of that warming, and places where we have good long-term monitoring, like Alaska, Hudson Bay in Canada, and the Barents Sea, we're seeing tremendous changes both at the ecosystem level and with declining polar bear populations.
Now, have we reached a point of no return? Is it possible to restore what has been done, the damage that has been done?
We have not reached the point of no return yet, but time is of the essence. We are lucky in the Arctic that sea ice responds very quickly to changes in carbon emissions. So if we can stabilize and ultimately quickly reduce carbon emissions, we'll see a stabilization of sea ice loss. What we will not see is we won't see that sea ice bounce back anytime soon until and unless we're able to pull some of that carbon back out of the atmosphere. So it's a bit of good news, bad news there. We've already impacted this system. If we turned off the taps today with our carbon emissions, that impact would continue for a time. The sooner we turn off the taps, the sooner we can reach that peak and start down again.
And I think you may have mentioned this, but is there a good estimate as to how many polar bears there are right now?
There is an estimate. I would say it's not a great one, and that's largely due to the lack of both historical data. We don't know how many polar bears there were back in the early 1900s, mid-1900s. Modern monitoring techniques didn't really come around to the polar bear world until the late 70s, early 80s. And then even today in places like most of coastal Russia, which is a huge part of the Arctic, we lack monitoring information in some regions altogether. So the total numbers we think are somewhere in that 16 to 23,000 range globally. And in places with really good monitoring data, we know that some of those subpopulations are in decline.
We are talking about climate change and specifically about the effects of climate change on polar bears with Jeff York, who you just heard, Polar Bear International Senior Director of Conservation. Also with us is Dr. Nataki Osborne-Jelks, Assistant Professor of Environmental and Health Sciences at Spelman College in Atlanta. And then when we come back from a break, we're going to be joined by John Walczak, Executive Director of the Louisville Zoo, which of course has two polar bears, and talk about some of their educational efforts in terms of climate change. We'll do it all after a break. You're listening to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. Welcome back to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett. Today we're talking about climate change, and we're having some of our focus on polar bears because tomorrow is the International Day of the Polar Bear. And here in Louisville, we have two polar bears at the Louisville Zoo that we're going to talk about in just a moment. But we're talking about climate change and a little bit about polar bears, too, with our guest, Dr. Nataki Osborne-Jelks, Assistant Professor of Environmental and Health Sciences at Spelman College in Atlanta. Jeff York has been nice enough to join us from Bozeman, Montana. He is Polar Bear International's Senior Director of Conservation, has been working and studying polar bears for a good part of 20 years up in the Arctic. And John Walczak is with us. He's Executive Director of the Louisville Zoo. He's been there since 1985, been director since 2004, and is going to be departing soon. He announced his retirement from the zoo this week. And we want to hear from you, too. What do you think about where we stand with climate change? 502-814-TALK, 502-814-8255. Its effect on wildlife, its effect on you and your neighborhood. 814-8255. You can send us a tweet. WFPL News is our handle, and we're also on Facebook. So, John, I want to turn to you and talk about the Louisville Zoo. You've had you've had polar bears at the zoo for a number of years now, haven't you?
Yeah, we have. Well, we were very successful throughout the 80s and 90s and actually propagating the polar bears and have learned a great deal about polar bear behavior. And then we took a little break to build our new exhibit. Our previous exhibit was tired, and we really felt that it was very important to have a strong conservation statement. So back in 2011, we opened Glacier Run, which is our new polar bear exhibit. And it was focused on conservation education and awareness, which is one of the greatest tools that we can help as a zoo in helping fight climate change and decreasing our carbon footprint. If you think about the name of the exhibit, even Glacier Run is implied that glaciers are moving more rapidly towards the sea. Throughout the exhibit, we talk about polar bear conservation, our partnership with Polar Bears International, and we actually modeled the exhibit after what is known as the polar bear capital of the world, a town called Churchill, Canada, that is on the shores of the Hudson Bay. And we wanted to take people from Louisville to that place where they could see the polar bears and understand the impacts of climate change and reflect back home as to what can we do to be part of a healthier balance for the planet in our behaviors.
And tell us about the two polar bears that are at the zoo now.
Yeah, we have Kanik. Kanik has got a very interesting story. Kanik was actually rescued from the North Slope of Alaska in 2011. Matter of fact, the day that we opened the exhibit is when they discovered that Kanik was abandoned by her mom. We don't know why, but that is not a typical polar bear. Females have twins, and sometimes they can even have triplets, but because they have less time out on the sea ice, they can't eat as much as they would in a normal year before climate change's impact. The twins, usually one survives and one may not. So Kanik was found abandoned and rescued by the biologists with ConocoPhillips and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And then taken to the Alaska Zoo, where they're a great facility, and they do wonderful work rehabilitating polar bears. And then the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Association of Zoos and Aquarium Species Survival Plan decided that Louisville was the best home for her. So Kanik has got a great story, and she's a remarkable bear. And then our other bear is a male named Lee, who was born at the Columbus Zoo. Lee's 22 years old. And just a wonderful bear. It's great to see the male and the female, because males will be more than twice the size of the female. So it's wonderful for the guests to see these incredible animal ambassadors, which are great representatives to talk about this existential threat that's facing all of us.
And I guess some would ask, John, how these bears adapt to living in a place like Kentucky in this part of the country, which obviously is not you have built an environment to replicate the Arctic as much as you can, but we are in this part of the country. How have they adapted to that?
Well, they are an adaptable animal, and there's 19 different populations of polar bears in the remnant wild, and some of those will see temperatures in the 70s and even in the 80s in Ontario and in Manitoba.
Oh.
So they aren't totally unfamiliar with warmer temperatures. But in our exhibit, they have a 85,000-gallon pool, which is chilled. The water is always in the 60s Fahrenheit, which is a very cold water. And we have two ice machines. We have an ice machine actually in one exhibit, and we give the bears lots and lots of ice, and their bedrooms are air-conditioned. And one of the things we do with the bears at Louisville is we want the very, very best for their animal welfare, so we emphasize choice. So we'll actually leave the doors open to their bedrooms, which are air-conditioned and below the exhibit, so if they want to go and cool off in a bedroom, they can do so. And, of course, we have keepers and interpreters there, so we can explain that just wait a few minutes if you didn't see a bear at first. You'll get to see them, but we allow them choice and comfort by providing the ice and the air conditioning.
Now, when we have an ice storm and heavy winter conditions like we did last week, do they high-five each other? Or are they delighted to see this, something like this happen?
they are having a great time. It's a great day for the snow leopards and the polar bears. They are really enjoying that freeze and the ice that we had that day. Although ice for us, like everything else, is for the zoo environment, ice is treacherous because we also have giraffes and elephants and other animals, which, of course, are not adapted to that. But the polar bears had a great time.
You're listening to In Conversation on WFPL. We're talking with John Walczak of the Louisville Zoo. Jeff York from Polar Bear International is here with us, and Dr. Nataki Osborne-Jelks, who is an assistant professor of environmental and health sciences at Spelman College in Atlanta, is joining us. We're talking about climate change in general, polar bears in particular, and we want to hear from you, too. 502-814-TALK is our number, 502-814-8255. You can send us a tweet. WFPL News is our handle, and you can reach us through Facebook. Let's take a couple of calls here. Let's go to this is our friend Jackie Green. Jackie from Louisville. Hello. Are you there, Jackie?
I am. How are you, Rick?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good, thanks. Rick, I'd like your panel's response to the following. Our local transportation patterns and Biden's automobile-dependent infrastructure both accelerate climate chaos. What's the response?
Well, Dr. Jelks, what are your thoughts about transportation and its effect on climate change? And Jackie, thanks for the question.
Thank you so much. That's a great question. When we think about, you know, transportation in particular, we've got to think about greenhouse gas emissions. We've got to think about, you know, the type of fuel that we're using and the amount of trips that we take. And so, you know, generally speaking, you know, there needs to be more investments in things like reliable public transportation that may be fueled by cleaner energy sources, anything that we can do to, you know, get out of our cars, making our cities and towns more walkable and bikeable. Those are things that can help as well. But we've got to keep our eye on the emissions. And, you know, to do that, we have to have other alternatives in place that can really, you know, kind of invite people out of their cars and to using these alternative modes of transportation.
Let's go to Robbins, Tennessee, and Terry. Hello, Terry. Whoops, let me try that again. Hello, Terry. Welcome to In Conversation.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Go right ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Rick, and your guests. I was pointing out that anybody that doesn't believe that man affects the climate, take off your shoes and socks and barefoot walk the 5 million miles of asphalt highway, and that's science that a 2-year-old can do. If they step on hot asphalt, they're going to step off of it real quick.
Yeah, well, thanks for the call, Terry. I want to talk about the urban heat island effect, but that's something that we experience here in Louisville. Let me go back to you, Dr. Jelks, because you've been doing a lot of work in the area of urban settings. And I promised to talk about this earlier. Tell us about the Atlanta Earth Tomorrow program that you co-founded.
Thank you for asking that question. The Atlanta Earth Tomorrow program is a program of the National Wildlife Federation, which is an organization that I previously worked with, but I'm still connected, still work with them, and still get an opportunity to contribute to the program. But it introduces youth of color, particularly at the high school age, to the environment, kind of holistically. We try to engage young people by connecting them to the outdoors and to the natural world. We connect them to opportunities that help them to expand their environmental literacy. We help them to, sort of identify and analyze environmental problems and challenges in their communities and come up with appropriate sort of youth-led solutions to how to address those issues. And then we also try to make sure that these young people are connected to career opportunities in the environmental and conservation fields. So through a year-long cycle of activities, they get exposed to, you know, colleges and universities that have environmental science or related programs, conservation-related programs, and they get a chance to, you know, meet with representatives from those colleges and universities, begin to learn about those academic programs, career opportunities that can come as a result of that. And then they have school-based clubs, environmental clubs, after-school clubs, in which those students also pick issues in their communities as well as on their school grounds to help address. It could be, you know, planting a wildlife garden, you know, on a school site. They might be working with community-based groups to, you know, work on water quality restoration, you know, in their local community. You know, the types of solutions that they, the types of issues that they identify and the solutions that they then also identify are varied based on the school and based on the community that those youth live in. But it's just a wonderful way to begin to equip this next generation of environmental stewards with the tools, skills, and education that they will need to be responsible citizens, but also to make a difference as we, you know, continue to work on attempts to mitigate the effects of climate change.
Are you finding that the young people generally are enthusiastic about taking this on?
I find that they are extremely enthusiastic and very passionate as well. For the young people, they see it. They can connect the dots. Between, you know, all the things that are happening, you know, kind of in our society. They are passionate. They care about, you know, what's happening, you know, with polar bears, and they see kind of that iconic figure, you know, of climate change discourse as something that's, you know, really important, you know, that we conserve, you know, those species. But then they also see the impact at home in their communities, and they see what's happening to human communities, and they want to make a difference to impact that positively as well.
And John Waldzak, let's come back to you. Let's talk about your educational mission at the zoo. Of course, the zoo is not just for coming and looking at animals, although that's a delightful way to spend the day. But you've spent a lot of time and energy on your educational mission. Talk about how you educate visitors about climate change, not only as it relates to the polar bear and your Glacier Run exhibit, but about wildlife in other parts of the world, like Africa and South America and here at home.
Oh, absolutely. And first, I'd like to thank Dr. Jelks for all of her work, especially with the Atlanta Earth Tomorrow, because that is such an important program. And that's a huge focus of not just our zoo, but all AZA-accredited zoos across the country. Are working to do is provide more access to our programming, because that is absolutely critical. So often the people that suffer the worst impacts of climate change are people of color, and the more that we can provide access, we talked about transportation a minute ago, and although we absolutely need clean transportation, we need to make sure that we provide access to all communities so they can get to their zoos. Some of the programs that we do, we've worked with several different partners, and we realize we have to start young, because for people to care about habitat and the environment, the younger we can start, the better we are. And we have programs ranging from pre-K to college. We have programs with the Enfield Center here in the community, where some lower and middle-income children have the opportunity to learn about animals and the impacts of climate change. We also partner with Polar Bears International and Jeff, who has a great educational program. And we have sent probably half a dozen or more students from Jefferson County up to the tundra, where they actually get to study with some of the leading polar bear biologists of the world. And then they come back and initiate projects here. Matter of fact, one student, Emily Goldstein, worked with former superintendent of schools Sheldon Berman. And just by talking to him and talking to JCPS about turning their computers off at 5 p.m., the energy savings was absolutely incredible. So these partnerships are absolutely huge. And the benefit of AZA-accredited zoos is more than 200 million people every year visit our zoos. So the work of the Louisville Zoo and all of our partners talking about what we can do to make a difference has got a huge impact. So we have programs from pre-K to the high school and college level. Some of our partnerships with organizations, NGOs such as Polar Bears International, gives us real-world frontline exposure to youth here in our community to help make a difference for the future.
And, Jeff, I want to give you a chance, Jeff York, Polar Bear International, to talk about your educational efforts. As John just alluded to, you take on young people to participate and learn in your program as well, right?
That's right. We realize at Polar Bears International that, you know, the problems polar bears face are really driven from both actions and inactions taken in the South, where most of us live. They're not problems that originate in the North. And so education and outreach is critical to the work we're doing, and our education and particularly our zoo partners are a key part of that, you know, really amplifying and creating much, much larger networks for messaging than we might have otherwise. And like, you know, both of our guests have mentioned, you know, polar bears can be this great starting place for discussion with folks who might not identify themselves as conservationists, but they like wildlife, they like nature. They like to take their kids, their grandkids, their niece, nephew to a zoo and to cruise around and be in that environment. And so when you get that moment, that connection, when they're standing in front of the polar bear exhibit at the Louisville Zoo and they ask, well, what's happening with polar bears in the wild? You know, through the programs like John mentioned, where we can bring his staff up to a place where they can see polar bears in the wild, where they can have one-on-one conversations with local people and with scientists about what's happening, what they're seeing, and bring that back to their communities and the very large audiences that they see on a daily basis. And then for us, when we amplify that out to our zoo and aquarium partners across North America and Europe, that's a huge audience, and it's a very important segment of people to be talking about climate change with.
John, I meant to ask you a while ago about the polar bears, Connick and Lee. Now, are they permanent residents of the zoo? I know Connick's been with you for quite a while, or is there a program where they move from one zoo to another?
They're going to be with us for quite a while. Connick's been with us for 10 years, but we cooperate with all the AVA-accredited zoos because we manage these populations for the best genetic and behavioral outcome. And we only have 45 polar bears in U.S. accredited zoos. So we have a very lean genetic base of founder stock to help keep this a sustainable population for generations to come. So they may move if at some point it's what's best for managing the species as a whole, but we take the individual into account. We'll look at the behavior of what male and female they might be paired with in the future to make sure they're a good behavioral match as well as genetic match. And, you know, one other element with the polar bears, you know, we look at them as the icon of climate change because of the melting of the sea ice, which is absolutely a paramount need. But the other thing that folks need to realize and what they can learn about polar bears is the irony is they are one of the most remarkable energy efficient mammals on the planet. When you consider a female polar bear will go into the maternal den and will not eat or drink for 3 months, and they only get to eat and drink for maybe 5 months, 6 months throughout the year, but they go through the two highest energy demands on the mammalian body of gestation and lactation, because they do this while they're having cubs and they're nursing their cubs for 3 months. It's really quite remarkable, the adaptation that they've made. So there's also this kind of ironic lesson to be learned about energy efficiency.
Let me stop you there, John. We'll come back to you. We're up against a break. We'll be back with more in a moment on In Conversation on WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. Welcome back to In Conversation on WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett. Today we're talking about climate change and specifically the effect of climate change on polar bears. As tomorrow is the International Day of the Polar Bear. Of course, we have two polar bears at the Louisville Zoo. We're talking with Jeff York of Polar Bear International Senior Director, who is Polar Bear International Senior Director of Conservation. John Waldsack with the Louisville Zoo is with us as well. And also with us is Dr. Nataki Osborne-Jelks, Assistant Professor of Environmental and Health Sciences at Spelman College in Atlanta, who's doing some great work with young people and civic engagement and many other things in the Atlanta area. And we'll talk a little bit more about some of the specific concerns they have in her part of the country in a moment. But, John, you were talking about polar bear behavior, and it was really fascinating how the life that, you know, that they lead, the gestation, that sort of thing. I'll let you pick up from there.
Yeah, thanks, Rick. The females are amazing because they go through that 3 months of gestation and then lactation without eating or drinking. And I don't know about you, but I have trouble going 3 hours without eating and drinking. So they're absolutely amazing model. And, of course, they're one of the animals on the planet that's suffering the most from climate change. So there is that irony there. And of course, sustainability. We talked about their populations in the remnant wild, and we also have that challenge in with bears under human care in accredited zoos, because there's only 45 of us, and we work very, very hard to make sure we could expand that population genetically so they stay healthy for a long, long time, which goes back to your question about will Connick and Lee stay here for a long period of time. That will remain to be seen according to what the need for the species is overall.
And as you mentioned, Connick was abandoned, right? So talk about how the decision is made and how polar bears are brought into captivity. Obviously, you don't go and catch them and bring them in, but in like Connick's situation, that was really a life-saving effort.
That's correct. Virtually all the animals in AZA accredited zoos are bred and born in accredited zoos. But what we also do is we work to help with rescue operations. In fact, our other bears, we have grizzly bears, which were also rescues that came from Tulsa, Montana, because believe it or not, as huge as Yellowstone is, it's really not large enough to support a sustainable population of grizzly bears. So animals will come to us. We offer our assistance to USGS and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services so that we can make the best use of our resources to help species like Connick or specimens like Connick. Connick is, we don't know why she was abandoned by her mom. The females, as I mentioned earlier, they usually don't have the energy reserves to nurse triplets and oftentimes not twins. So it might have been that the Connick was not getting enough nutrition from mom and just lagged behind because polar bears travel great distances and the cubs, they need to be ready to do that as well.
Jeff York, I want to come back to you, Polar Bear International Senior Director of Conservation. Talk a little bit about what you do going up into the Arctic. Are there certain times of year that you go and study the polar bear and the effects of climate change on the polar bear? Talk about your process there.
Sure. So kind of the life of a polar bear field biologist around the Arctic, most work is done in the springtime. As it starts to warm up, we still consider it to be pretty cold. We usually are going out when temperatures are anywhere from minus 20 to 20 above. But when the sea ice is still safe enough to work on for us and to land a helicopter, most of the work is done as far as capture work using small helicopters. And we fly out over the ice for hours at a time searching for bears out in a snowy, icy environment. It's very much like finding a needle in a haystack.
Now, have you had any encounters, scary encounters? Because I polar bears are probably a little cranky when somebody comes to visit, I would think, as adorable as they look. Have you had any scary encounters with them that over the years?
Absolutely. A few close encounters and charges. I would say the most infamous was when a partner and I were studying polar bear dens, looking at where they den, why they choose certain areas. And we had a number of dens with collared females in that we went to after they left. And then we would go in to the den, take measurements, and try to get a better feel for why she might have chosen that spot. Well, we had a couple of dens of uncollared females that we were keeping an eye on. And when we went to measure one that we were sure had been abandoned, it was not. And she let us know pretty quickly that we were not welcome to hang out there. So luckily, nobody was hurt in that incident.
Have you noticed in your years any adaptations that polar bears have made to the loss of sea ice and other results of climate change?
That's a good question. And from a biological standpoint, when we use the word adaptation, that's something that happens over almost a geologic timescale. So it takes many, many years for true adaptations to occur in nature. And what we're seeing now with climate warming is something that's happening at an unprecedented pace, much too rapidly for bears to adapt. That being said, are we seeing bears change their behavior? Absolutely. In places like Russia, at the Beaufort Sea, and definitely in Hudson Bay, we're seeing more bears spend longer time on land than they used to. Now, for most of the world's polar bears, they historically didn't come ashore at all, other than to den on the very near shore of coastal islands for pregnant females. So adult males and non-pregnant females stayed on the ice year-round. That's changing around the Arctic as that sea ice is disappearing.
And, I was looking at frequently asked questions on your website, and one is a very good question. Could polar bears survive by mating with grizzlies or other bears? Does that happen? Can it happen?
It does happen. It's only happened one place in the Arctic, near Victoria Island in the far northwestern part, actually north of mainland Canada, and it was a result of one female polar bear over subsequent years mating with two male brown bears. So it was very unusual. Hasn't been seen before or since in our lifetimes, but we do know, looking at genetic history, polar bears and brown bears have interbred off and on throughout the course of their evolution. And so it is a natural part of their, I would say, co-evolution.
Well, the Arctic is not just a United States-controlled area. There are other countries in the mix as well, Canada, Norway, Russia. What is the cooperation like among governments and among organizations among those countries in terms of studying the polar bear and having a common goal of conserving the polar bear?
I would say at the staff level, it's fantastic. There's a shared concern for polar bears. There is a lot of information sharing that results from that, scientists and among managers. Some of that occurs through the IUCN Polar Bear Specialist Group. Some of that occurs through biannual meetings of the Polar Bear Range States, which is more of a political meeting. But I would say all of it is hampered by our politics. And that's true around the Arctic. As governments change every so many years, we have very different perspectives on things like climate change, things like Arctic oil and gas development, things like Arctic shipping that directly impact polar bear conservation and directly impact governments in terms of their prioritization of some of those issues.
We're talking about climate change, its effect on humans and on polar bears as well, and on our environment and the planet as a whole, with Jeff York, Polar Bear International Senior Director of Conservation, John Waltzak, Director of the Louisville Zoo, is with us, and also Dr. Nataki Osborne-Jelks, Assistant Professor of Environmental and Health Sciences at Spelman College in Atlanta. We want to hear from you, too, if you have some thoughts on this. 502-814-TALK is our number, 502-814-8255. You can send us a tweet if you don't want to talk on the phone, or you can reach us through Facebook. I want to come back to you, Dr. Jelks, and talk about some things going on specifically in your part of the country, in Atlanta and Georgia. Two issues, among others, that we have here in Louisville are, of course, conservation of the Ohio River tributaries, or right on the river here, and combating the urban heat island effect, which has been a problem for us in Louisville for a number of years. Talk a little bit about what situations you're facing in Atlanta and in Georgia.
So in Atlanta and in Georgia, we're facing some of those same issues and challenges. I tend to focus a lot of my work in Atlanta, so I'm much more well-versed there. But, you know, we definitely see wide-ranging impacts in the state of Georgia as we talk about, you know, water issues, especially on the coast. You know, sea level rise is an issue. We have challenges with our, you know, agriculture, with not only urban agriculture, but, you know, Georgia is an agricultural state. So we see those types of impacts. In the city of Atlanta in particular, urban flooding is a challenge, as there are projections that we will have a lot more precipitation in future years. And more intense storms kind of, you know, hitting these areas, that urban flooding is a major issue, especially in Atlanta neighborhoods where people live along creeks and streams. And so we've seen, you know, a number of challenges up to this point with that flooding that impacts communities in negative ways. Also in the city, there is an effort to try to strengthen our tree protection ordinance. If we think about trees as those sinks, carbon sinks that are helping us to, you know, clean the air as we think about carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. And so, you know, at a city level, there is a kind of a rewrite of our tree protection ordinance, and many groups on the ground don't feel like that the things that are being proposed with that rewrite are strong enough to not only protect trees, but to protect the communities that receive ecosystem benefits and, you know, services from those trees being in our neighborhoods. So those are the types of things that we're focused on, in addition to working on trying to enhance our infrastructure. As we think about, you know, things like more precipitation, more intense storms, again, this issue of flooding comes up. And so the issues around flooding are compounded by the fact that we don't have a strong we don't have dedicated funding in the city of Atlanta and in other places to address stormwater issues. We don't have, you know, strong stormwater infrastructure in place. And so as we think about those solutions that will make communities more resilient and more resourceful, you know, kind of in the face of climate change, then our infrastructure cannot be a pre-existing condition. But for so many of our communities, especially communities that have been historically redlined, that is the case. And so those are the types of things that we are working to address in Atlanta.
502-814-TALK is our number, 502-814-8255, as we're talking about climate change this hour on In Conversation. And it looks like Shannon from Louisville is waiting on line two. Shannon, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
Good to have you with us. What's on your mind?
Well, I had one question that I was sort of wondering about. I'm 70 years old, and I never hear any talk now about population control as far as the impact of our growing populations on the climate. We hear a lot about cars and industry and agriculture, but we don't hear, and I see that there's a trend for families to get bigger now, not smaller. When I was young and starting a family, we were told just to have one or two children, and now we have, we never hear about the population impact, the impact of our growing populations on the climate. And then the other one was the impact of the travel industry on climate.
Well, Shannon, thank you for your call. Let me turn to you, Dr. Jelks, for that. We haven't heard a lot of talk about populations, more about what people do than the number of people. Is that an issue? Is that something that's talked about?
Well, it is an issue that's talked about, and there are a number of organizations that are kind of focused on looking at, you know, the population impacts. However, what I can say is that, you know, even though maybe this conversation is not sort of in our everyday lexicon, or you know, it's not widespread in the media, what has also been found is that, you know, we do have to be concerned about the number of the people on the planet, but also if there was specific attention paid to the countries that are more affluent, who are contributing most to climate change, what you find is that even in some cases where populations might be higher in some parts of the world, if these are not the countries that are more affluent, they tend not to be the ones who are contributing the most to climate change. And so there has been a lot of pushback on that argument around population for that very reason.
And that's a good question, Shannon. Thank you for your call. Before we run out of time, John Waltzak with the Louisville Zoo, I want to talk about your announcement this week that you are retiring. You're going to stick around for a little while before you leave, right?
Oh, yeah. Louisville is our adopted home. We've been here for 36 years, and it was interesting reading Dr. Jelk's bio, you know, looking at what might be the next chapter. I'm inspired by her work with Atlanta Earth Tomorrow because I'm very much interested in dedicated to conservation and also racial equity. So when I read her bio, a light bulb turned on. That maybe that might be the next chapter.
And what would you like to see for the future for the zoo as you depart?
Oh, well, you know, the zoo is such a jewel, and we want to reach out more and more to the community. We are that resource. We're the place where people can come and forget about their everyday problems, especially this last year suffering the pandemic. We're so fortunate to be a beautiful outdoor venue where people can come out and enjoy the fresh air. And along with that, we're a conservation resource, like this program today and the conversations about polar bears. We're here where people can learn through these incredibly charismatic animals about the plight that's happening throughout the world in the remnant wild, because it's important for people to understand that the wild are little patches that basically are all managed by human beings in some capacity or another. So for the zoo, we have a big mission. We have facility expansion that we need to do, and we have a great, great team. So I think zoos are absolutely essential to the needs of human beings today. I don't think there's ever been a more important time in the history of the planet for human beings. And on the horizon, I think another exhibit we're trying to look at is Kentucky, because it's important for people to understand home and the natural systems here at home, as well as polar bears or elephants or the oceans. So there's lots of projects that we want to see forward. Someday we'd even like to have sharks in Louisville, because that's a whole other program to talk about our oceans and what we needed to preserve 70% of the Earth's surface in those systems.
And Jeff York, before we run out of time, for those who are interested in helping with polar bear conservation and things related, how could they get involved? How can they get in touch with you?
They can learn more about Polar Bears International by checking us out on our website at polarbearsinternational.org. And we have a tremendous outreach and education toolkit, a ton of videos for both adults and kids to learn more about the Arctic and polar bear conservation, and most importantly about the impacts and threats of climate change and what they can do to help.
Well, I want to thank you all for joining us. John Waldzak, especially good luck and all the best with your retirement. Jeff York, Polar Bear International, thank you for joining us. And thank you so much, Dr. Nataki Osborne-Jelks, for bringing your perspective from Atlanta and Georgia. Appreciate having all of you on today. We also want to thank our In Conversation production team, Michelle Tyreen Johnson, Laura Ellis, Brad Yost, Russell Wells, and Bill Burton. If you want to listen back to this or any of our past shows, you'll find us wherever you get your podcasts and at WFPL.org. You can email us with your thoughts and show suggestions at inconversation@WFPL.org. And I'm Rick Hallett. Thanks for listening.